In the week that Kenneth Branagh's film Belfast hits the cinemas, with its nostalgic and sad view of the Belfast he left when he was a boy, comes a short film called The Reavie Brothers, co-written and directed by John Reavie. It tells the story of how John's young uncles were the victims of a horrendous sectarian murder in 1976 in County Armagh. The film has been a sellout at its screenings in Newry. Delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by a co-writer and director of The Reavie Brothers, John Reavie. John, tell us what happened on that night in January the 4th, 1976, 10 past 6. Must be a time that's etched on all of your family's memories. What happened to your three uncles, Anthony, John Martin and Brian?
Yes, so I mean, listen, back in 1976, we all know Northern Ireland was a totally different place. And my three uncles, part of a large family, were sitting in their home watching Celebrity Squares on television at the time, when they were tragically murdered in their own home. Two of them were shot dead and murdered instantly. And Anthony, the youngest brother, died later in hospital, which is just, it's crazy to think about.
Yeah, and I'm sure, was this something in the family that was constantly there as you grew up, John? Was it something that was talked about, something that was remembered, something that cast a huge shadow over the family?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, growing up as a Reavie, even introducing myself to people all across Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, people are aware of the story. And it's something I've grown up with, always knowing, as it's such a huge staple in the local community.
Yeah, and I suppose Reavie is an unusual name, and when you hear of the murders of the Reavie brothers, it does bring us back to that time. And even if we wouldn't have all the details, some of it would be sparked in the memories of anybody who was around during the 70s. Maybe give us a sense of the town, the area that we're talking about here, Whitecross in South Armagh in 1976. What kind of place are we talking about?
We're talking about somewhere very, very small town village. 200 people probably living there at the time. The boys lived in a little cottage house, isolated really from neighbours within driving distance. And there was, you know, Northern Ireland back then was a totally different place. You know, both Catholics and Protestant communities were traumatized at that stage, and it was definitely a place that you lived in fear. And I'm very lucky that I've grown up in a generation totally different to that.
And Whitecross itself, would it be part of, or would it be within what was often referred to as the murder triangle in South Armagh?
I mean, it would have definitely been one of the areas that was thought of at the stage, for sure. Yeah, like within Whitecross and surrounding areas, there was so many tragic incidences like this that happened.
And in fact, if not only a couple of nights before your uncles were murdered, there had been the murder of three Protestants in the area as well.
That's right, yeah. So it's one of those ones that not only were the Reavie family victims, there were families from all sort of backgrounds, all different sort of communities that have stories like this, and it's a real tragic tragedy that these things happened.
Yeah, it's part of what was often referred to as the time as tit for tat killings, which is such a kind of almost a dismissive terms for what were reprisals for absolutely no reason. People were chosen purely because of their faith. Whether they were strong in that faith or not, that was enough for you to be murdered. And the stories are unfortunately legion of that period in time. however, there's a scene in the film. Well, actually, let's go to a scene between the three brothers. It gives us a sense of the dynamic between Anthony Brown and John Martin. Anthony was a writer.
He was. Now, Anthony had a hobby of writing. He used to write poems about the farm he grew up on. Used to write about pigs, sheep, cows, which is really interesting considering he clearly had a creative mind for such a young age. He was 17.
Yeah, so that kind of rural upbringing was very much part of what he was writing about. But he was writing, certainly in terms of the poem that we hear in this clip that we're going to hear him speaking. It's Anthony, or Dylan Llewellyn, who's playing the part of Anthony. He's reading a poem that he's been written. He's thinking about sending it off to a local competition. He won a competition for poetry in primary 7. And again, that seems to have been part of the family lore. Anthony was the writer, the guy who won the poetry competition in primary 7. But here he is sharing a little bit of his most recent poem or effort at a poem with his two brothers, John Martin, played by Niall McNamee, and Brian, played by Kevin Nugent.
That's right, yeah. Wanted to have...
What's this then?
Huh? I thought you were doing a drawing or something.
Who's this for? Is this for the girl who cuts ham over in the shop?
No. It's a poem, you idiot. There's a competition or not.
Oh, dead on. What's coming on, like?
Do you just want to hear it so far?
Yeah, go on.
Every day I hear the streets of Whitewash tremble. In the night of our lives, how many brothers and sisters will pass and never come back? And that's all I have so far.
Jesus fucking Christ. You went downhill something terrible since your P7 poem.
Jesus, not like it.
Yeah, it's class, but no, my head's that kind of carry on.
Now, boys, what would I hate there?
And that's the mammy of the Reevee City, played by Geraldine McAlinda, just at the end of that clip, featuring Niall McNamee as John Martin Reevee, Kevin Nugent as Brian Reevee, and Dylan Llewellyn as Anthony Reevee, the three Reevee brothers who were murdered on the night of January the 4th, 1976. And their nephew, John Reevee, has made a short film about the events leading up to that particular night. And John is speaking with me this evening. You get a real sense that the three guys were real buddies. I mean, we see them playing, they're out in playing the Ga together. They're hanging around the place, generally having fun. There seemed to have been a great camaraderie and friendship between them.
For sure. I mean, the reality is that these were three quite unextraordinary fellas at the time. You know, they lived normal lives. They did everything that normal kids and young adults growing up in South Armagh at the time did. And they would have been really close buddies.
And the other thing, there's a scene, I think it might be in and around the little clip that we just heard about, in fact, where there's two Protestant brothers, the Graham brothers, played by Neil and Paddy Heaney, where there's a little bit of banter going on between the two Protestant brothers and the two Catholic brothers. And to say the very least, they just seem like great buddies. I think we see them out playing pool and having drinks together later on in the film as well.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I did my research and discovered that the Reevee family had Protestant friends, and I really wanted to include that in this piece, as it kind of represents that this family weren't seeking any sort of bad intentions and actually were friends with people from the other communities. And it's a real shame that a family like that were targeted.
Yeah, yeah. And in the same way, as you said, like as the Reevee family were targeted, other brothers were targeted, Protestant families were targeted immediately afterwards, and indeed there were wasn't there a murder on 10 Protestant workmen shot dead by the side of the road heading to work in minibus not long afterwards as well. But we get a sense there that even as a young man, Anthony was aware of this idea of a kind of a pacifist's attitude. We get the completed version of that poem later on in the film. Does the poem still exist?
So the poem, this short film is based on the true story, and Anthony never wrote a poem about his feelings towards the Troubles. However, we do understand that the Reevee family always preached no sort of retaliation. And whenever I was writing the script, I imagined that a 17-year-old boy like Anthony Reevee growing up at the time would have wanted no retaliation and would have wanted these things to end. So what we did was we told his feelings through a poem. So that's kind of where that comes into place.
And in fact, isn't it the truth that there were 8 brothers in total, 5 surviving brothers, obviously, after the three were shot, and their father insisted that they would promise him that they would never go near any kind of violent activity?
that is true. And for an absolute gentleman of a man, Jimmy Reavy, to come out after losing three of his sons through a tragic murder to say that truly shows the Reavy way and legacy that they've left behind.
Yeah, and indeed, there's another little clip that I'll play now from the film where the mother, the boys have been out in the pub and the soldiers have come into the pub. Perhaps it's the UDR. I'm not quite sure which particular part of the defence forces have come into the pub on the night. But they come into the pub anyway, and they're kind of rough handling some of the Catholic men and Catholics in the pub. And the two boy, the three boys are quite annoyed about it. But let's listen to how Sadie, the mother, what she says to the boys after they come home, and she asks them about what went on in the pub, what went on. Geraldine McAlinden as Sadie Reavy.
Right. What happened?
It's got out of hand. It's on that.
Right, boys. I really mean it when I say this. I really need you to swear on the family Bible that you'll stay away from this sort of thing.
And that's Geraldine McAlinden there as Sadie Reavy in John Reavy's short film, The Reavy Brothers. I was amazed, John, at what you packed into. I think the film in total is maybe 19, 20 minutes long, somewhere in that region. It really is very powerful stuff. Do you think there's more to be told around this story? Do you think you could extend it into a larger feature film? Or are you quite happy with what you've done? Do you feel you've honoured your uncles and you don't want to do any more?
No, absolutely. I mean, creating this piece, 20 minutes was always a barrier we almost had in place. It was what we had funding-wise to create. And I have no doubt that I have left out so many details. And, you know, I couldn't even go into the whole after the story or tell too much before, as I had to make sure that the general viewer could enjoy those 20 minutes. And although I'm really proud of what I've packed into those 20, this definitely needs to be longer, and I'm literally so keen to continue telling the story.
And I guess that's why the film is showing in Uri at the moment. What kind of reaction has it been getting? Are you getting the type of encouragement that might encourage you to look for further funding to make a longer feature film?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had people come from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of communities, and they all have been watching the film and reminiscing to those times, thinking about people that maybe they've lost at this time, thinking about specific people in their memory, and they all want something longer. And in my mind, that's a response.
I think we've lost John there, but he has told us what we need to hear about the film. If you get you're there, John. So the hope is that you will get an opportunity then to make things. And I see a lot of the Reavy family were involved in the cast. You'll have all of them in the feature film, I presume, as well.
Oh, that would be a dream. I mean, I'm sure half of them might be a little bit camera shy, but I would have to speak away with them and make sure that they would love to get involved.
Well, listen, great to have spoken with you this evening, and thanks for sharing the film with us. That's John Reavy speaking about his film The Reavy Brothers, currently on show in Uri, and if you get a chance to see it at all, do grab that opportunity. The fashion icon, journalist and king of the front row, André Leon Talley, has died at the age of 73. For decades, he was the larger-than-life creative director and editor-at-large at US Vogue. And if his personality was outsized, so was his physical stature, standing at 6'6" or 6'7", depending on what you read. Always immaculately turned out, his personal style drew him to the dapper bespoke suits, robes, capes and caftans. He was a regal presence in the fashion world, and famously said, "You can be aristocratic without being born into an aristocratic family." André was raised by his grandmother in the segregated city of Durham, North Carolina. And in June of 2020, he was interviewed here in Arena by my colleague Kay Sheehy. His second memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, had just been published. As a boy, André was obsessed with Vogue magazine, and he told Kay what it was about those pages that enchanted him so.
Opening the pages of Vogue was like going on a huge trip. I had not been out of my hometown before that time, so it was a luxury voyage, an escape into the world of art, literature, poetry, dance, music, Rolling Stones, the Beatles, literature, Truman Capote, Eudora Welty. It just opened up my mind to a world outside of my surroundings that seemed so exciting, and that's what it really meant to me. To open the page of Vogue was not just look at the models, It was what was written in Vogue, what was recorded in Vogue. People are talking about the great people are talking about column was very much a fascinating point for me. It was a great, I would say it was like a moment of escapism.
You were blessed to have two strong female role models very early on in your life, your grandmother who raised you, and then the former Vogue editor, Diana Vreeland, who gave you your first career break. How would you describe their influence?
Both women were very much similar, but they were from different, opposite sides of the world. Mrs. Vreeland was a white woman of a very elitist world, and privileged world, brought up and raised, born in Paris, was a Vogue editor, a bizarre editor for 28 years before she became a Vogue editor. My grandmother was a domestic maid, but in their similarities to me were they believed in the same values, discipline, honor, decency, empathy towards your other fellow mankind, passion, curiosity, and they believed in maintenance. Maintenance was next to cleanliness. Cleanliness was next to godliness. And you maintained everything. Mrs. Vreeland polished the soles of her shoes with a rhinoceros horn. Well, she didn't polish them herself. She had an assistant polish them. My grandmother had me polish the floors of our house with Johnson's paste wax and a cloth. So everything was pristine. Polish. Polish is a discipline. When military people polish their boots, when they shine their boots, how needed they pack their kits. All of this was a value about discipline, maintenance, and just having great good values about being. And this is what they both had in common.
In his career, Andre Leon Talley worked with Andy Warhol at The Factory. He wrote for Interview magazine, The New York Times and Women's Wear Daily, where in fact he was Paris bureau chief. Then he joined US Vogue in 1983 and began his working relationship with Anna Wintour, who, of course, went on to become editor of that magazine, a role she still holds. And when he was speaking with Kay, Andre also talked about working at Vogue and indeed working with Anna Wintour.
Anna Wintour is extraordinary. We were very, very so close. We spoke the same language without speaking the same language. We could look at each other and think of what she was thinking I could translate and resolve. She was a brilliant editor. She is a brilliant editor. And she was just the new wave at Vogue. And so in 83, I went to Vogue. She was already there. By 1988, she'd become the editor-in-chief of Vogue. And she made me the second most important person on the masthead, creative director. I was the first Black African-American man is creative director at Vogue. That has happened then. It's never happened since. The only time it came close to something like that was when Edward Innenfeld, who's been knighted by the Queen Elizabeth II, took over British Vogue and became editor-in-chief. When I got the news that morning, I emailed him away and said, congratulations, Edward. I knew him very well. And he says, thank you, Andre. You paved the way. That made me feel so great that he said, I paved the way. But nobody else has ever been named creative director at any Condé Nast magazine, Black, that I know of. Maybe you can correct me. I don't know.
Andre, you mentioned there Edward Innenfeld, who is now the editor of British Vogue, and he seems to be very political in his coverage. He's pushing the frontline staff on the new edition of Vogue, and he's also done covers about empowering women. Do you
Wonderful human being. Wonderful man.
Do you think fashion magazines should be doing more that is overtly political or even more subtly political?
Well, I think that fashion magazines have got to turn a page, excuse the pun, and realize that the world has changed. The new norm is not what the old norms were. Yes, they have got to put people on the covers who are making change and who are changing society. They've got to put people on the cover who are advocates for social injustice, advocates for changing the laws about police brutality. I think Edward has done an extraordinary job. Recently, he did the most extraordinary thing when he put Dame Judi Dench on the cover at 85 years of age. This is historical. This is historical. Edward Innenfeld, a Black man, puts a white lady, Dame Judi Dench, who deserves it, by the way, at the age of 85. There's never been an 85-year-old woman as a cover of any Vogue. This is how you make history. You have people in the charge who are visionaries. So therefore, Vogue has got to take the mantle up and create platforms where people are like Beyonce, who will be an advocate for equality in the music entertainment industry, for women. You know, women are not in the forefront in the music entertainment industry. The Me Too movement, people like that. I think that when Edward did his great story, he allowed the Duchess of Sussex to be the editor, guest editor. That was a great move. She did not put herself on the cover. She put women on the cover, women that she admired who made a difference. When you make a difference in life, it's not because of what you wear on your back. It's because who you are, to help others, empathy, be kind to your fellow man, how you help humanity to become better. How can you make the world a better place? That is the platform that Vogue should take for the future. How to make the world a better place?
The irrepressible Andre Leon Talley speaking to Kay Sheehy on Arena in June of 2020. And Andre Leon's death was announced today. January 1921, an IRA ambush goes wrong and the murder of the Honourable Maud Prendeville draws World War I veteran turned IRA intelligence officer Tom Harkin to Kilcolgan House, the crumbling family seat of the Prendeville family. This is a house as haunted by its past as it is threatened by the violence of its present. Here to tell me more about his new novel, The Winter Guest, is author William Ryan. The thing that really strikes me about this novel is the point at which you've chosen to set this ambush, January 1921, William. It really is in the aftermath. The First World War is barely over and the War of Independence is pretty much at its height at this point in time. You wanted to bring those two historical events together, I'm guessing.
Yes. Well, I think they were connected in some ways, certainly for Irish people who were part of World War I, who went over and served with the British Army. Tom Harkin would have joined up as one of the original Irish volunteers with a view to getting independence for Ireland as much as keeping independence for the small nations of Europe. And so he goes and he experiences four pretty horrible years in the trenches, and then he comes back to find an Ireland that has completely changed. And he is bringing with him his ghosts and his experiences from the First World War, and finds himself in another war, one which is in many ways just as complicated, just as brutal.
And I suppose you kind of wrong-foot us slightly because we know he's an IRA intelligence officer, so there is a slight wrong-footing in his then having been involved in the First World War, even though we would have had lots of the Redmond Knights, we might think of, who fought in that war in the hope that that would lead to some form of independence subsequently. But you also set us slightly awry in the Prendeville family, who we think of perhaps as the local landed family. But that's not all. They are not all they seem either.
Well, I think that they have, kind of different loyalties even amongst themselves. And Maud Prendeville, the woman who dies in the ambush, kind of fought in the Easter Rising and suffered her own trauma as a result, and has retired to. Kind of her family home in a coastal county. And kind of the rest of her family would probably be more loyalists. So it's kind of complicated.
Yeah, and even within that, the rest of the family, and we can't go into the intricacies of the plot, but there's lots of not quite knowing what you're getting when you look at any of these characters. But a huge character undoubtedly in the novel is Kilcolgan House. Maybe you would describe this imagined place in your head, or was there some model for it somewhere, or is there some model for it somewhere?
Well, the original idea for the house came from a novel by Edith Somerville called The Big House at Inver, which has a house called Kilronan House, I think, if I remember. Hmm. And that's based on a house called Tyrone House near Kilcolgan and Galway. Which was burnt down in the 1920s. But it also has echoes of other houses as well. There are big houses all over Ireland. I mean, you kind of see them from the road, and sometimes they're intact and they're hotels where there are people living there, and sometimes they are burnt out ruins. And that's a lot of that happened during the War of Independence and the Civil War between 1919 and 1923. I think nearly 300 houses were burnt down for various reasons. And that is, you know, kind of the threat which is hanging over this family, as it hung over many other families at the time.
You give us the character of Harkin and how haunted he is himself. So many times he sees people walking towards him, and he thinks it's somebody who fought in the war with him who he thought was dead. And sometimes it is somebody that he thought was dead and isn't dead at all. They're alive and well. That aspect of what was often referred to as at the time as shell shock, but we would now refer to as post-traumatic stress disorder, how important an aspect of that was it for you in the telling of the story here?
I think it's very important for his character, and it's important for the story as well. So he's slightly detached from reality. He's living in a version of the world that the other characters live in, but his is populated with people from the past and experiences from the past, he's obviously living in quite a stressful environment, and with the constant fear of arrest or summary execution, and it's probably not the ideal environment for somebody like him. And then he comes to Kilcolgan, which has its own memories, because he was romantically entangled with Maud Prendeville, but also they may be ghosts or there may be something inside his head, and that's where it's kind of fun for me as a writer to sort of blend the two different versions of reality.
Yeah, because we see a lot of his dreams, we see nightmares that Harkin has, and they are truly frightening to him, the possibilities of something that could or might happen. But there's quite definitely a supernatural element within what you're telling as well.
Well, it felt right for the house. When the novel started off, maybe the supernatural element wasn't so pronounced, but gradually, over the course of the novel, the house became more decrepit and the ghosts became more visible. And it was fun to write, and I hope it's fun to read as well. The story took on a little bit of a life of its own, which is always fun as a writer.
Yes, there's an aspect or a kind of a legend within the Prendeville family lore, this idea of the White Lady. You might explain that, because it is something that exists in many families' lores, whether it's the White Lady or it's some other aspect of some other superstition that they have. But explain what the White Lady is in terms of the Prendervilles.
It's a ghost that appears when a Prenderville is about to die. And I think that there are several Anglo-Irish families that have similar spirits. There's a great book called The Irish Country House, which has a chapter on ghosts, which I have to admit I found very useful.
That's very succinctly put. I found it very useful. You got some good material in there, is what you're telling me, really, William. You went to school at Glenstall, and I believe the part of the inspiration for what happened to Maud, this idea of her being killed as part of an ambush, whether it's an accident or not, is what the novel is all about. But was there a story that you heard while at Glenstall that kind of stuck with you that has made its way into this novel?
Well, Glenstall was originally owned by the Barrington family, and Winifred Barrington, the daughter of the house, was travelling in a car with an RIC inspector in early 1921, and she was mistakenly shot in an ambush and died. And this would be a story that we were all very familiar with as 13-year-olds and older. And it happened a few miles away from Glenstall, and was a tragedy. It wasn't intentional. She was wearing a military cap. She served as an ambulance driver in World War I. And it was unfortunate. The Barrington family were very popular. They built Barrington's Hospital in Limerick, and Winifred herself was well respected, but it just was one of those tragic incidents. And the Barringtons sold the house, and it ended up as a monastery and then a boarding school. And I got to spend 5 very cold and damp years there.
I'm sure you would want to say very
out of it as well.
Well, if you got the stories out of it, you can forgive the coldness and dampness that was there, if you, as you say. Your other books also have historical settings. They often say when you write about history, you're writing about something in the present day. Did you have any sense of that as you wrote this novel, The Winter Guest?
I think to an extent, because, I think at this moment in time, but I think it's the same throughout history, we often we don't necessarily see the other side of the argument or the debate or indeed the war. And I think that Harkin is somebody who sees all the different sides and sees the tragedy of it as well. And I think that it works very well for the novel, but it's a kind of, I suppose it would be a slightly different novel to one that might have been written 50 years ago. Hopefully it's a little bit more thought-provoking and looks at history in a different way. I mean, when I write, I generally write historical fiction. I write about small history, about ordinary people in very difficult times and how they cope with that. And that's, I think, what Harkin is doing. He's an ordinary man with some very difficult personal problems, finding himself in a very tricky situation with very tangled loyalties.
All right. Well, thanks for speaking to us this evening about the novel. That's William Ryan there, and the novel that William, WC as he is on the book, WC Ryan, the book that William was telling us about is The Winter Guest, and it's published by Zafra. Wicklow artist Sam Keogh's Sated Peasant, Sated Soldier, Sated Scribe was originally commissioned for the basement galleries of Goldsmiths Centre for Contemporary Art in London. That was last year. It's now been reconfigured for the Carlin Gallery in Dublin. The exhibition of sculpture, collage and audio draws on pre-modern myths and motifs of abundance. It recalls the medieval myth of the land of Cocaine. Cocaine is a place of plenty where even the skies rain cheese, work is abolished and sexual liberation is everywhere. I'm joined by Sam Keogh now to tell us more. Bruegel the Elder's painting The Land of Cocaine from 1567 shows plenty of and freedom that you are, I think, riffing on in terms of this new this exhibition of yours, Sam. Maybe tell us, describe that particular painting for us, if you would, the image that Bruegel the Elder gave you.
Yeah, the Land of Cocaine, it's quite a small painting, oil on panel. It's something like 20 by 30 inches. And it depicts these three figures, a soldier, a peasant, and a clerk lying underneath a tree which has been turned into a table filled with food. And the whole painting is, it's kind of, to describe it visually, I guess it's made in like muted tones of brown and yellow. There's very little green. There's very little sense of anything that's alive. Everything is kind of beige and brown. There's a feeling of cookedness. the historian talks about it as feeling like it feels like the whole thing is like a distended stomach, that it's kind of swollen and filled with gas. In his description, you can almost smell the farts when you read what he writes about it, because it's just this kind of this land of kind of plenty, but kind of stodgy inertia as well.
So when we read of a place of plenty, whatever about raining cheese, which might be a little bit over the top in terms of what you'd be getting, but no work, sexual liberation, and as I say, this land of freedom. On the surface, it sounds hugely positive, and somewhere that we might want to be. But is there a cautionary tale element to Bruegel the Elder's painting, and in what you want to do then in the exhibition?
Well, the painting the painting also kind of comes from these medieval or pre-modern prose poems about the land of Cocaine, where you'd get like traveling troops of musicians and poets kind of telling the story of the land of Cocaine. as this peasant fantasy of abundance. But it also had to be couched in kind of Christian moral values. So it was a warning to the gluttonous. This is a place that you would end up as a purgatory, a purgatory of indigestion rather than heaven. So you'd be kind of stuck there, not able to digest the plenty that is always on offer. And I was kind of interested in that dual function of it, because I suppose when it was popular in the Middle Ages, it had to have this moralistic quality for a lot of the parts of Northern Europe that it was being kind of consumed in. So as the poets or artists who were interested in it weren't kind of hunted down by the church, but still it remained a kind of a container of this of this proto-communist fantasy of plenty, and something about its nonsensical nature, I think, really made it survive for centuries. Yeah,
because there is an incredibly modern feel to it as well, despite the fact that it's a painting from the 16th century. Let us then go to your own experience in Stansted Airport, which I think again feeds into how the Bruegel painting makes its way into your exhibition, or how it and your experience in Stansted certainly feed into this current exhibition.
Yeah, well, so the exhibition is made of primarily these very large collages on big red sheets of paper filled with small drawings of flowers, unicorns, food. Another important text that I was drawing from was The Lady and the Unicorn tapestries, these 16th century Flemish tapestries, which are now in the Cluny Museum. So there are these huge surfaces, which are similarly drawing on these pre-modern myths of abundance, but they're made on paper, and they were made so as I could fit them into a suitcase, because at one point in their making, it was, you know, midway through the pandemic in Berlin, it was between December and January, the post even stopped, and then added to Brexit, I was just worried that I wasn't going to be able to get this to London unless I had it on my person. So it was made to be folded into a suitcase. So I got a new suitcase at Kopra Serbruka in this Turkish homeware store, and I put everything into the suitcase, and I wheeled the suitcase through the border tunnel. And I was one of the only people in the airport because of COVID, and there was these six border cops lined up, and one of them stepped out and wanted to check my bag. So I put my bag in the X-ray machine, and she kept asking me if I had tobacco on me. And I said, no, I don't have tobacco. And she came out the other end and she repeated this question.
Were you in any way nervous? Has this happened to you? You know, when you're stopped at, I think it, no matter how innocent you may be, if you're stopped like that at an airport checkup, it can be a checkpoint. It can be very disconcerting, and you almost begin to look guilty, even though you may have absolutely nothing to be guilty about.
Yeah, I was really scared. I mean, I'm a middle-class white Irish guy, so I'm not really subject to police power in the ways that a lot of other people might be at a border, but these people still have the ability to indefinitely detain you, and a lot of them kind of take pleasure in that power. So you're kind of at the mercy of a border cop if they want to search your bag. But I didn't have anything in my bag that I thought would be incriminating, but still it was kind of this moment of interrogation, which ended when they opened the bag and they saw all of these collages of flowers and unicorns and food and quite prettily rendered. Mm. And they were kind of like, what is this? And without stopping, I just said that I said it was these series of collages based on a 15th century tapestry called The Lady and the Unicorn, blah, 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 blah. And there's so much specific information that the questions just stopped and they were disappointed. And they said, okay, you can go. So in the kind of audio document performance, or the kind of the soundtrack to the installation, mm. I tell this story, but the story is kind of dressed up in some of the images which are within the installation. So the police become... One of the cops is a pig. One of the cops is
When you say a pig there, you're using that quite literally. You imagine them literally with the physical characteristics of a pig rather than any kind of metaphorical statement.
Yeah, I mean, I'm using it as both. I mean, they're both versions of the pig, which kind of unfolds through the telling of the story. And yeah, turning them into these figures allows me to kind of enfold other stories and histories and anecdotes within the kind of compacted contents of this bag that pops open with all of these flowers and unicorns and so forth.
Tell me a little bit more about, I suppose, the myth of the unicorn and how that feeds into this idea of plenty that you want to do, that you're kind of, I suppose, exploring in the exhibition.
Well, it's a series of the Lady and the Unicorn tapestries. There's six tapestries. They're kind of allegorical. Symbolic meaning is lost to history, but it's speculated that each one means something to do with each of the five senses plus a sixth. But I was more interested in this motif in the background called Mille Fleurs, or a thousand flowers, which might be familiar to listeners as something which the artist William Morris was interested in and reviving when he was practicing. And it literally just depicts like every space in the background of the tapestry filled with plants and animals in simultaneous fruit and bloom. So it's an image of kind of temporally impossible abundance, because a lot of these plants won't be possible for them to be blooming and fruiting at the same time. And as part of the story that I tell, I kind of speculate that when these tapestries were made by the team of weavers in a tapestry studio, the main artist of the studio would make the kind of figures in the foreground, but they would leave the background up to the tapestry weavers, and they would be allowed to improvise. Mm. So I speculate that the team of weavers in this kind of permission to improvise, they take it as a chance to take pleasure in their work and to begin to kind of siphon more time and silk and money out of the aristocratic patrons who are kind of paying their wage.
And the other aspect that I think is, so we have these tapestries on display in the Carolyn Gallery, as you've described them, that were in the bag that you could pass, you could through the border guards with. But there are also then sculptures, figures on the ground itself, kind of not unlike the Bruegel figures, back to the painting that we spoke about, almost as if they're buried in the ground, or part of them is buried in the ground. Is that a direct, I suppose, homage or lift from the Bruegel image?
It is, yeah. They're kind of three figures which are taken from the base of the tree in this painting. And I really kind of tried to kind of recreate the sense of gravity in that painting, that the figures were heavy in themselves to the point of being kind of sucked into the ground by the gravity of their own kind of satiated laziness or something like that.
So
there are these...
They are the sated soldier, sated peasant, and sated scribe of the exhibition's title.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Sam, thanks for speaking to us about the exhibition this evening. That's Sam Keogh, and that exhibition, Sated Soldier, Sated Peasant, Sated Scribe, is at the Carolyn Gallery. It'll be there from the 22nd of January through until the 19th of February. You can find out full details on carolyngallery.com.